Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone phone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Dr. Messner, please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Krista, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's program. And today's program is a collaborative effort between the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation and Cancer Care. And today's program is updates from the 47th Annual San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, or SABCS, on triple negative breast cancer. And today's program is made possible by the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation, Gilead, and an independent grant from Merck and Company, Inc., and we thank them for their support of this program. Now, before I introduce our first speakers, I just want to let you know that there's about 210 participants on the call today. You come from all of the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have a number of international participants from Afghanistan, Canada, India, Pakistan, the Philippines, Romania, South Africa, Uganda, and the United Kingdom. So it is a global call, and it's a credit to all of you that you're spending the next hour with us to learn more about the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium on triple negative breast cancer. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Kate Lathrop. And Dr. Lathrop is Associate Professor, Division of Hematology and Oncology, UT Health San Antonio Breast Medical Oncology, Mays Cancer Center at UT Health San Antonio, Assistant Dean of Undergraduate Research, Long School of Medicine, UT Health San Antonio, Program Director, Medical Oncology and Hematology Fellowship Program at UT Health San Antonio, and Program Director, San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, or SABCS. And Dr. Lathrop will be addressing an overview of triple negative breast cancer presented at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium on triple negative breast cancer and triple negative breast cancer specific treatment updates. It is my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Lathrop.
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be invited to speak with you about some of the important updates for triple negative breast cancer that was presented at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium this year in December. Since I have the pleasure of talking first, I want to maybe take about a minute just to introduce what we mean by triple negative breast cancer. And triple negative breast cancer is named for what it's not. It does not have expression of a receptor, which is called an estrogen receptor or a progesterone receptor. Sometimes those are referred to as hormone receptor positive breast cancers as a group. And it also lacks expression of another receptor, which is called HER2. And we have targets, medicines that we can give directly to target the hormone receptors and the HER2 receptors. And unfortunately, for triple negative breast cancer, those medicines or therapies don't work. And so the main drive of our research in triple negative breast cancer is to find therapies that specifically work well on triple negative breast cancer. And a few themes came out of the research that was presented at SABCS this year focused on that. The first one I want to speak about is a type of medicine which is called a PARP inhibitor. PARP is a protein in our cells that can help with repairing errors when our cells replicate and the DNA is copied. And for women with triple negative breast cancers that have certain genetic changes, the most common ones that people might be familiar with are mutations in a set of genes called BRCA, BRCA1 and BRCA2. These medicines can help prevent recurrence of those breast cancers after being treated. So we did have a presentation. It was a long-term follow-up. It was 10 years of overall follow-up on a trial called the Olympiad trial, which looked at adding a PARP inhibitor. The name of that medicine is olaparib, for women who were a little bit higher risk based on the size of their triple-negative breast cancer and whether or not they had lymph node involvement. And those women, after they completed their initial therapy with chemotherapy, surgery, and radiation, half of that group went on to receive a medication for a year, which was olaparib, and the other half was given a placebo. And those patients were watched, and we have average data for those women of more than 6 years. Now, most of the patients on that trial were triple-negative breast cancer patients. Some of them were also estrogen or hormone receptor positive. Both groups of patients were allowed on the trial. But specifically looking at the triple-negative group, this long-term follow-up did show that there was a significant benefit for being on these PARP inhibitors for a duration of 1 year in decreasing the risk of the cancer returning in the patients that received olaparib. And the difference was about 10%. So obviously we want to balance out side effects to medicines versus the benefits of being on those medicines. So this long-term follow-up was very helpful in being able to see that we did get benefit in decreasing the risk of recurrence for women with triple-negative breast cancer who also have a genetic mutation in the BRCA 1 or 2. The other focus from the triple-negative trials this year at SABCS was really trying to figure out which women might benefit to a type of therapy called immunotherapy. Immunotherapy is different than chemotherapy or even the medicine I was just mentioned before, olaparib, in that it works by activating the body's immune system against the cancer. So the idea is that this is effective, that this treatment will actually have benefit even after we are no longer giving the immunotherapy, because we've almost trained the immune system to become part of the surveillance for any remaining cancer cells. And then that helps decrease recurrence because your body's own immune system can fight the cancer cells for you going forward. We know for women who have what's called metastatic breast cancer, when the breast cancer is spread to other parts of the body, if their cancer cells have a protein or expression of a protein called PD-L1, then we can use these immunotherapies to help slow down the growth of cancer in those patients. What we're trying to do is figure out who we can give these medicines to early on in treatment for women who do not have metastatic triple-negative breast cancer to then help decrease the risk of recurrence of their cancer. Again, we want to only give medicines to people who are going to benefit from it because these medicines do have side effects. And one of the other speakers today is going to go into the side effects of immunotherapy. So we'll hear about that a little bit later. But they can be pretty significant. And unlike some other side effects, they don't necessarily go away when we stop the medicines. So we want to make sure that we're choosing the group of patients who are going to benefit from these medicines and really try to give those women immunotherapies, but not give them to women who we can potentially harm and not hurt. So there was two clinical trials looking at this that were presented at SABCS this year. These have really long names because they're part of cooperative groups. Those are groups of doctors that get together and run trials together. The one was called the NSABP 59, and that was a group that's in the United States, and they collaborated with a German group to look at an immunotherapy which is called atezolizumab. And that medicine was given to women with their chemotherapy before surgery. And what that trial overall did not show that there was a significant benefit in giving immunotherapy to the whole population of women that went on this trial. So patients were allowed on this trial whether or not they had this protein, which is called PD-L1. There's also another way of looking at the tumor and seeing if maybe it's a tumor that would respond to immunotherapy, and that's if they have these special cells from our immune system inside the tumor cells, and those are called tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes. So women went and men went on this trial. They looked at the PD-L1 expression, and they looked at those pills as part of the process of enrolling, so that later we can look to see if the presence of those things actually help us predict which women are going to benefit from those medicines. And so what's interesting is also there is another trial, which is called the ABRAVE trial, that was presented. And that trial actually has some of that data already analyzed. And what they were able to see was that for patients who went on to the clinical trial and received an immunotherapy, although a slightly different immunotherapy, still the same type of medicine, if they had the PD-L1 expression and if they had these tumor infiltrating lymphocytes, these parts of our own immune system embedded in the tumor, then those are the patients that had a much better response to the immunotherapy and a decreased risk of recurrence. What the trial also showed that was that for women who had a complete resolution of their tumor with medicine before surgery, they also had a decreased risk of recurrence. So I think these trials are both going to help us know which women we can potentially use immunotherapy in to help decrease recurrence.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Lathrop. That was just a wonderful presentation. And because you're the first speaker, and you are the program director of the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, actually, it was great to have you lead off this call today. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. It's an exquisite presentation and lots of information that you were able to deliver to people. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Julie Fisher. And Dr. Fisher is medical oncologist, Levine Cancer Institute, co-director, Sandra Levine Young Women's Breast Cancer Program, associate hematology oncology fellowship director, Levine Cancer Institute. And Dr. Fisher will be addressing the increasing role of diagnostic testing, biomarkers, and genetic testing in informing treatment options, and updates on clinical trials in advancing treatment choices, investigational new therapies in clinical trials. It's really my pleasure now to introduce Dr. Fisher to you, to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Fisher.
Great. Thank you so much. Welcome, everyone, and I'm very glad to be here. The landscape is shifting in terms of the various diagnostic tests that we have at our disposal. We've got a lot of new technologies that are in various stages of development, and the challenge we have now is kind of determining, okay, what's the right application for this? What do we do with the information these tests are going to give us? And ultimately, how is it going to impact patient care? Dr. Lathrop, of course, just discussed, kind of the update of the Olympiad trial looking at olaparib, which is a PARP inhibitor. And that's exclusively beneficial for patients who harbor inherited BRCA1 and 2 mutations. So clearly, germline or, testing for the genetic abnormalities that we inherit from our families, directly impacts drug selection for drugs like that. And again, looking at kind of more diagnostic information, the beauty of a lot of these clinical trials is that it helps us define drugs that may be helpful in treating breast cancer. Many trials are also designed to take blood and tumor samples during treatment, which can then be analyzed so we can get kind of deeper information. The KEYNOTE trial is a trial that many people are familiar with. It is what defined the benefit of adding an immunotherapy called pembrolizumab to kind of standard preoperative chemotherapy a few years back. And it showed an increased incidence of pathologic complete response. As I tell my patients, we do preoperative therapy, and then we see kind of how well it worked in the breast once we get the pathology report. Sometimes you'll get a partial response, which is sort of self-explanatory. The chemo has killed, some portion of the cancer. Anything that's left behind has been removed by the surgeon. Other times, you get a complete pathologic response, often somewhat self-evident, but, the surgeon goes in, and lo and behold, the tumor was completely eradicated by the preoperative chemotherapy. The update to the so previously, the Keynote trial showed us that we saw more pathologic complete responses with the addition of the pembrolizumab. One of the updates that we had from the Keynote trial during San Antonio this past December was that we're also seeing an improvement in overall survival in people who got the immunotherapy. And in addition, they were able to assess certain biomarkers, certain characteristics of the tumors that can predict improved pathologic complete response rates, regardless of whether the patient received pembrolizumab. So I know this sounds a little wordy, but essentially the trial identified markers that will help us predict whether pembrolizumab is helpful or not. And of course, as Dr. Lathrop described, and as my colleague Dr. Yadav will get to subsequently, the side effect profiles of these medications can be pretty significant. So anytime we're going to be able to tailor treatment to the individual is going to be a win. So again, some of these markers are being identified, and eventually I think we will get to a place where we are using those to help define care. Similarly, another trial, CALGB40603, there was paired DNA and RNA analysis, and again, they identified some potential prognostic markers that, may eventually help us tailor, so this cancer will respond to this drug, this cancer is not going to respond as robustly, and then we can make sure we're giving patients the drugs that will benefit them, sparing them the potential side effects of drugs that are not going to be helpful. And finally, an area that is of great interest to pretty much anyone who's interested in breast cancer. I know this is something a lot of my patients are interested in. My colleagues and I discuss this a lot. And that is the application of circulating tumor DNA testing. Again, this technology is available. We can test people's blood to see if there are any circulating tumor DNA, kind of floating about. And it's been FDA approved. One of the tests has been FDA approved. The issue that we have, kind of as a medical institution is, well, gosh, once we get that information, what in the world do we do with it? You know, if someone is negative, does that mean that there's no risk that they're going to recur? If someone is positive, but they have totally undetectable disease, their scans are completely negative, are we meant to treat that? And if so, what's the endpoint? Just because we have the test doesn't mean we should be utilizing the test until we know exactly what that's going to look like. And there was a study called the ZEST study that was hoping to address, an aspect of this. Basically, it was looking to address if patients with triple-negative breast cancer who were found to have positive circulating tumor DNA after their initial treatment, it was looking to see if those patients were going to benefit from additional therapy with a PARP inhibitor called niraparib. Unfortunately, the study had to stop prematurely. There were some issues with low enrollment and issues kind of getting enough patients who fit the criteria for the study on board. But I think, so while this study, was ambitious and hoping to answer an important question, while this wasn't successful, I think it's important to highlight it as kind of illustrating this is the kind of thing we need to be doing to determine if these tests are useful or not. A result that we don't know how to act on is not super helpful, so we're all still kind of working on that. And as I tell my patients, that the technology is there, it's not quite ready for prime time. There will be other studies. There are other studies that are ongoing, and hopefully we'll start answering some of these questions. As far as kind of clinical trial and drug updates specific to patients with triple-negative breast cancer, some of these, of course, have already been addressed. A couple of other studies of interest. There were two different trials looking at two different forms of immunotherapy. One is a novel agent called BNT327. This was a phase two trial that looked at including this immunotherapy drug with neoadjuvant chemotherapy, and showed indeed that this agent improved pathologic complete response rate. A phase three trial of that is planned. And another immunotherapy agent called Kemrelizumab also increased past CR rates. So just, again, these different immunotherapies have different pros and cons and side effect profiles. Clearly, the more variety and choice we have, the better. While we're talking about immunotherapy, another study looked at a combination program of immunotherapy that we call in the biz IPI-NIVO, which stands for ipilimumab and nivolumab. This combination is used, with lots of background and experience, in the melanoma cohort and in other cancers as well. A trial compared that to adjuvant capecitabine for people who had residual disease following neoadjuvant chemotherapy. So, triple-negative breast cancer patients got neoadjuvant chemotherapy. If they had a partial response, that's considered residual disease. A trial several years back showed that those patients with triple-negative disease benefited from a course of oral chemotherapy with a drug called capecitabine. This trial compared capecitabine to the IPI-NIVO combo and didn't really show any advantage when the immunotherapy was added. Again, a great example of if it's not going to add benefit, why would we move on with a drug that's going to confer additional toxicity? And then finally, the Invincible 2 trial, an interesting study that looks at direct injection of a drug called INT230-6. That drug is injected directly into tumors, and this was done in human subjects, and was shown that this direct injection can cause tumor death and also potentiate an ongoing immune response, which can also, again, of course, help with cancer cell death. So lots of kind of interesting new things always kind of coming down the pike. I'm sorry if I went over my time. There's so much to discuss. And just a broad overview of those topics. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Fisher. That was just a wonderful presentation. Lots of material for people to absorb and bring it back to the healthcare team. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Sitara Yadav. And Dr. Yadav is Associate Professor of Oncology, Mayo Clinic, and Dr. Yadav will be addressing new developments in the prevention and management of treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort, and pain presented at SABCS, and guidelines to prepare for telehealth, telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, adherence, follow-up care, and discussion of open notes. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Yadav.
Thank you very much for having me. And today we heard quite a bit about immunotherapy from Dr. Lathrop and Dr. Fisher. So my goal primarily is to talk a little bit about toxicities, and I will focus primarily on toxicities from immunotherapies, drugs like pembrolizumab. And we know that we use this quite frequently in triple-negative breast cancer now, both in the neoadjuvant and in the metastatic setting. And it has the immunotherapies have shown to improve long-term outcomes, but they do come at the cost of additional side effects. And the interesting thing about these side effects is that these are very different side effects compared to what we are used to seeing from traditional chemotherapy. So there were quite a few studies presented at San Antonio this year that evaluated the side effects of these drugs. The first thing I think to think about is when we look at the initial studies with these drugs, especially Keytruda, what they had presented in the original trial was that approximately one-third of patients receiving the drug would develop any immune-related side effects, and almost 10% would develop serious side effects that would require urgent medical intervention. Now, these are clinical trials. Now, how does that rate of side effects translate into when we treat real-world patients? And so some of the studies presented actually showed that the rates of side effects was much higher in the real-world setting, meaning in actual clinical practice. So they found that rather than one-third that was presented in the initial trial, almost two-thirds of patients had some side effects from drugs like immunotherapies in real-world setting, and almost 20% had serious side effects. So clearly, much higher rate than what we were seeing in clinical trials. But then they also looked into what are the potential factors that predict who is going to get side effects. And two things have jumped out. One was men or women who were older than age 50 were more likely to develop side effects from immunotherapy drugs. And also those who had underlying chronic kidney disease were also likely to develop some of these side effects. So the other study that looked into the side effects of immune checkpoint inhibitors or immunotherapies was from Dr. Sarah Zacob, and they looked into long-term side effects or side effects that happen even after stopping the drug. So what they were interested in looking into is immune-related side effects more than 60 days after stopping drugs such as Keytruda. And they found that almost 9% of patients, so closer to 10%, had side effects that presented almost 2 months after stopping the drug. So there is this delayed onset of toxicity that we were not previously quite familiar with. So it's quite interesting to think that, you know, we need to be aware of these side effects and monitor patients even after they have stopped the drug. The other study that was also presented looking into side effects of drugs like Keytruda was looking into the risk of developing blood clots or heart disease. So because drugs like Keytruda or immunotherapies are quite new, we do not really understand their long-term side effect profile. And one of the studies presented this year demonstrated that there is almost twofold increased risk of developing heart disease in those who receive drugs like immunotherapies. And these include not just inflammation in the heart, which we sometimes see with the immunotherapies, but also increased risk of problems such as heart attacks or heart rhythm problems. So that is quite novel, and we obviously, you know, these findings will need to be investigated and confirmed in future studies. But for now, I think we need to be vigilant about these side effects, including the risk of heart disease, delayed onset of toxicities, and these higher rates of side effects that we are seeing in general. Now, the traditional side effects that we think from immunotherapies are more so related to involvement of thyroid gland. We see that in roughly one quarter of patients that undergo treatment. Rash is common. There is some risk of colon inflammation with presenting usually with diarrhea. And then there is also risk of liver inflammation or lung inflammation. And then one of the serious side effects we worry about is adrenal insufficiency, which usually patients who are receiving these drugs would present with severe fatigue. So any of these side effects, obviously, you know, patients need to talk to their doctors and undergo early evaluation for these side effects. The next study that I want to talk a little bit about is looking into chemotherapy toxicity. And so paclitaxel or docetaxel, these are taxanes, we call them, are commonly used chemotherapy agents in triple-negative breast cancer. One of the problematic side effects of these drugs is neuropathy, which presents with numbness and tingling in hands and feet, and there are very limited options available to prevent neuropathy. At San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium this year, a randomized trial evaluating the effect of cryotherapy, so this is cooling the hands or feet, was presented, and they used elastogel frozen gloves and socks in hands and feet starting 15 minutes before chemotherapy. They underwent this cooling effect during chemotherapy and lasted up to 15 minutes after the use of chemotherapy. The results were disappointing, however. There wasn't significant difference in the rates of neuropathy as such. Between the groups that received this cooling cryotherapy versus the group that did not receive this. So both groups had almost similar rates of neuropathy. Less sensory symptoms, not of neuropathy, but just the tactile sensation was less. So we do not know if this is clinically meaningful, and the study is still following patients long-term. So this is just in the short-term, we didn't see any benefit, but we still don't know if there is any long-term benefit. So at this point, I think, even though a lot of my patients also undergo this cryotherapy, this study kind of suggests that there may not be much benefit in terms of reducing the rates of neuropathy, but we still need a little bit more long-term follow-up data to truly understand if there is any benefit at all. The last study I want to talk a little bit about is, and this is interesting in the sense that, this is using technology in breast cancer management. So this is a study called as PRO-B trial, which was conducted across more than 50 centers in Germany. And what they were looking at is patients who had breast cancer, metastatic breast cancer, were monitored through a mobile application, through an app, every week. One group received that app monitoring every week in terms of their symptoms, and another group received monitoring every 3 months, just as a control group. Interestingly, the group that was receiving the monitoring every week, if they had any increase in symptoms, concerning symptoms, the team would then send a notification to their doctors, and the doctors were required to respond within 48 hours of that symptoms, of the noting of the symptoms. Now, what was noted in 6 months of doing this is that the group that had received that weekly monitoring of symptoms, they had less fatigue at 6 month time point compared to the group that was being monitored every 3 months with that app. But more importantly, and very interestingly, patients who received weekly monitoring also had better overall survival. That is, they lived longer compared to those receiving this monitoring every 3 months. And these results are fascinating and tell us that careful monitoring of symptoms and early intervention might actually improve long-term outcomes. I mean, this kind of makes sense as patients in the study had metastatic breast cancer and more than 50% were receiving active chemotherapy. So obviously, these patients had a lot of symptoms, but intervening early led to long-term improvement in outcomes. Fascinating study. Really curious to see how this can be implemented in our daily clinical practice and how we can leverage intense monitoring to improve patient outcomes. Okay, switching topics a little bit, I think I was asked to talk a little bit about preparing for telehealth, telemedicine appointments in the context of triple-negative breast cancer. So I will just go quickly through some of the things that I think are important. First thing is, when you're thinking of telemedicine, technology preparation is the key, right? So you should make sure that you have good device. And often I would say if it is a smartphone, tablet, or computer, make sure that you have good audio-video connections there. You know, you check your sound, make sure that your internet connection is really good, Wi-Fi is better than using cell phones. And so, that's important. Camera and microphone. I think microphone is also very important, especially when you're thinking from feedback, having a headphone is usually helpful. That avoids getting feedback. And then make sure that you can do some test run before you actually join for telemedicine visits. You can talk to a family member or some places, some clinician, institutions will even allow you to do test calls. So definitely utilize that because it's always challenging if you find that, you don't have the right equipment when you are doing the telemedicine call. So that's, I think, one key thing that you need to prepare before even going for the call. Second thing I would say is always prepare a list of questions that you want to ask, especially questions that are really important for you. And set that tone even in the beginning. A lot of time I'll ask my patients what are their key concerns, but sometimes it may be helpful just from a patient standpoint to just tell your doctor as to what are the things that you are looking for in that visit. For triple-negative breast cancer, I think key questions to think about are genetic testing of the tumor, germline genetic testing, and we heard a little bit from Dr. Latrop and Dr. Fisher about how genetic testing is changing, how we think about treatments today. Ask questions about immunotherapy. Is immunotherapy useful for your situation? Treatment-related side effects. Ask questions about clinical trials. Are there trials available that would be relevant for you? And then think about labs, imaging, questions like that. Finally, I think one thing that I was asked to talk about, and I will mention this, is talking about reading your doctor's notes. So once you're done with your visit, right, today, at least in the United States, a lot of places will put in electronic notes, and those will be available to you. Make sure that you read those notes and read those in detail, because it's important to know what your doctor is thinking for you. Sometimes the things that they go in background in terms of why they are making certain decisions, look into those and try to understand those and ask questions if there are any questions or confusions. Also read through, if you have availability of your imaging and pathology reports, read through those so that you understand your disease better and you can ask questions or advocate for yourself in the future. I think that's all I had. So with that, I'll stop. And again, thank you very much for having me for this very enlightening talk and topic of discussion. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Yadav. That was just a wonderful presentation. A lot of really important information for people to have, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Arlene Brothers, and Ms. Brothers is Director of Administration, Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation, and she'll be talking about Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation's free programs and services, and she'll be giving information about how to contact them. It's my pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague and partner on today's program, Ms. Brothers.
Thank you, Dr. Mesner. Also, thank you to all the amazing presenters and all of you who joined in to listen today. This teleconference is one of many programs offered by the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation. TNBC Foundation is heavily invested in TNBC-specific research, and we work hard to keep you informed about new and emerging research and treatment options. As a complement to this teleconference, please visit our website, yourguidetosabcs.org, for more information about the data shared at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium about TNBC, as well as interviews with top researchers. Additionally, we have many TNBC-specific educational brochures and fact sheets that are available in print and as free downloads from our website, tnbcfoundation.org. We're confident that you will find relevant information and practical guidance in our material, so I hope you will use them to your benefit. Also on our website, we have two free and TNBC-specific clinical trials matching services that are much easier to navigate than other portals. Our other online resources include discussion forums and a TNBC Foundation Facebook group, so you could easily connect with thousands of women who are living with TNBC at any time of the day or night. These resources are here to help you and to remind you that you are not alone. Finally, we have a number of monthly Zoom meetups for our TNBC community. Metastatic Mondays, Tuesdays with TNBC Friends, and Thriver Thursdays. And in partnership with TOUCH, the Black Breast Cancer Alliance, we have an additional monthly Zoom meetup specifically for Black women. If you follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or visit our website, tnbcfoundation.org, you will get regular updates and be able to register for these and all of our upcoming programs. So once again, thank you for joining us, and I'll now turn the program back to Dr. Mesner.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Brothers. That was just a wonderful presentation, a wonderful resource. So many of you may know about the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation, but for those of you who don't, please take advantage of all the resources that they offer. It is a go-to place for triple negative breast cancer, definitely. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Danielle Saff. Danielle Saff is Clinical Supervisor, Older Adult Program Manager, Cancer Care, and Ms. Saff will be addressing Cancer Care's free programs and services, and she'll be addressing also the TNBC helpline and other resources at Cancer Care. And it's my pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Saff.
Thank you, Dr. Mesner. As mentioned, my name is Danielle Saff, and I'm a licensed clinical social worker at Cancer Care. The Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation and Cancer Care have partnered together to ensure that those diagnosed with TNBC have access to free services and support. Some comprehensive services that the TNBC Foundation and Cancer Care provide include resource navigation, counseling and support groups, educational workshops, publications, and limited financial assistance. And by calling the TNBC helpline, individuals are connected with an oncology social worker who is aware of the physical, emotional, and practical challenges that may arise when diagnosed. There are many aspects of a TNBC diagnosis that could be addressed throughout psychosocial supportive services, and working one-on-one with an oncology social worker can offer a safe space to express one's feelings, emotions, and concerns. Not only that, but individuals diagnosed may also choose to supplement existing social networks by joining a support group. And a support group in particular can offer the chance for patients to speak with one another, gather information, and provide support. So the TNBC Foundation and Cancer Care offer a TNBC-specific national online support group for those diagnosed, and these are all moderated by oncology social workers. Individuals may also experience practical and financial concerns throughout one's treatment, and at Cancer Care, we offer resource navigation, which is a short-term, strengths-based approach to help patients and caregivers affected by cancer nationally. So a trained specialist will work with you in connecting one to resources, referrals, and financial assistance. And if you're interested in learning more about the services that the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation and Cancer Care offer, I encourage you to call the TNBC helpline at 877-880-8622, and our oncology social workers can help share additional information. It has been such a pleasure to be a part of this very informative program today. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to speak, and I will now turn the program back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Seth. That was just a wonderful presentation and also a wonderful resource as well. So between the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation and the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Helpline, all the participants should have really a go-to place for their questions. We're now going to move on to the Q&A, and I'm going to ask Julianne to explain to everybody, ask Krista to explain to everybody how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Well, ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
I have a question for Dr. Lathrop. Since there are several different types of triple negatives, some more aggressive than others, does the KI-67 provide insight into which type?
We don't use those outside of research as far as what treatments we currently choose for patients with early triple negative breast cancer. The KI-67, just to explain what it is, it, when the pathologist, who's the physician that looks at the tissue under the microscope, looks at the tumor, they count the number of cells that are in the active process of dividing. And the KI-67 is then that activity expressed as a percentage. So if it is 40, it means when the pathologist looks at it under the microscope, 40 out of 100 cells are in the process of dividing and multiplying their cellular structures and DNA. Compare that to normal breast tissue, which is, you know, usually around 2, maybe 3%, depending on when the biopsy is done. So you can use the KI-67 to get a sense for how fast the tumor is growing. And generally in our younger patients, we will see that the KI-67s tend to be a little bit higher, and those tumors tend to be a little bit more aggressive. But right now we don't use that just as one, you know, we don't use therapies just because of the KI-67.
Thank you so much. A question for Dr. Fisher. If a person is PR and HER2 negative, but ER 5% positive, is treatment the same as for total triple? Should this person suppress the estrogen positivity with ovarian suppression?
So that's such a great question. And I would say, technically, any degree of estrogen receptor positivity means the patient, you know, is estrogen receptor positive. But in practice, most of us would essentially approach that as a triple negative breast cancer in terms of treatment. You know, that said, any degree of estrogen sensitivity means that there's going to be some small benefit to anti-estrogen therapies. So typically, I will offer that to a patient, recognizing that the benefit will not be as significant as it would be for somebody with more robustly sensitive disease. If somebody's having tremendous troubles with side effects, I'd have a much lower threshold for stopping. But the short answer is that is not a true triple negative, but in practice, it's probably going to be approached as a triple negative. But then on the back end, yes, I would employ endocrine-based therapy afterwards.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And for Dr. Yadav, if a metastatic triple negative uses an opioid for extreme pain, will it interfere with immunotherapy?
Thanks for that question. At least at this point, we do not have any evidence suggesting that that would be contraindicated. So I'm very comfortable prescribing opiates for pain control in patients who are using immunotherapies. That's not a major concern at this point.
Okay, thank you so much. And a question for Dr. Lathrop. Which triple treatments penetrate the blood-brain barrier? Keytruda, Xeloda, chemo?
Yeah, so really good question. Xeloda is also known as capecitabine, and we do think that there's benefit for capecitabine in patients who have metastatic disease to the brain. It's part of our preferential treatment that we used in a regimen for HER2-positive breast cancer. There is emerging data that sacituzumab, which we did not discuss on the call today, but is approved in the metastatic setting for triple-negative breast cancer, does have penetration into the brain. I think an important thing to think about when we're discussing the blood-brain barrier and penetration is whether that barrier has been disrupted. So patients who have had surgery, like to resect a lesion in the brain, that disruption of the blood-brain barrier actually may help our drugs get into the brain a little bit better. We do still use what's called intrathecal chemotherapy for women who have metastatic disease to the brain or the lining of the brain in the spinal cord, which is called leptomeningeal disease. We still employ direct administration of chemotherapy drugs into that space in the body to get around the blood-brain barrier. We know that immunotherapy can cause encephalitis and inflammation of the brain and the meninges. So there's at least potentially some activation of the immune cells from giving immunotherapy.
Excellent. And then another question for Dr. Yadav. Where can I find more, Dr. Yadav, where can I find more about the trial on the drug injected directly into a tumor mentioned by Dr. Fisher? I am particularly interested if this would apply to the non-operable local recurrence in the post-mastectomy scar tissue and surrounding skin?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I wonder if the resources that were talked about the updates from San Antonio would have the name of the trial and if there is a NCT number that somebody could look it up. I am not sure that this would be applicable in the early setting. This was more in the metastatic setting, is my understanding, but Dr. Fisher could comment more on that.
Dr. Fisher, did...
Yes, I believe this was actually neoadjuvant, and it's still early stage data. It's not yet, it's not yet in clinical use.
Excellent. Thank you. And for Dr. Yadav, are there any updates related to the side effects of Trodelvy?
Yeah. So Trodelvy, sacituzumab, there were some studies that were presented not from a side effect management perspective, more like updates. And generally speaking, the side effects that we were aware of, those were confirmed in those studies. So for Trodelvy or sacituzumab, the key side effect that we are worried about is diarrhea. And we see that in over half of the patients. So that was confirmed in those studies. The side effects related to blood counts and other issues, those were confirmed as well. So apart from confirming the side effects, I did not see anything that would be new information in terms of management of those side effects.
Thank you. And question for Dr. Lathrop. There is a TNBC vaccine in trial. Can the panel speak about it currently being trial at Mayo Clinic?
Sure. I'm not familiar with exactly which one the patient is inquiring about at the Mayo Clinic, but there are multiple vaccines in trial currently for triple negative breast patients and for HER2 positive or the main tumor types that have been targeted for vaccine therapy, which is similar to what we're trying to do with immunotherapy by activating the body's own immune response, the T cells to the cancer cells. So those are actively being developed. Some of them are targeting other proteins like GlobO-H. So far, those have not come into being FDA approved yet. And the ones that I've been seeing more commonly are being used after initial treatment to help prevent recurrence. There was quite a bit of research done about 8 years ago looking at it in the metastatic setting. And unfortunately, those didn't show a significant ability to control the cancer cells.
And I can give a brief update on the vaccine trial at Mayo. So it is a trial that targets folate receptor 1 in triple-negative breast cancer and was used in the earlier setting after completion of all treatment surgeries to try to reduce the risk of recurrence. The trial is currently on pause right now, but it should reopen at some time with the next phase of the trial is being planned right now.
Excellent, thank you. And I'm going to ask each of our speakers to give a takeaway. So I'm going to start with Dr. Lathrop.
Yeah, I think my takeaway from SEBCS this year and specifically reviewing these trials with you guys today is that we are really focused on trying to sort out patients that need more therapy to help decrease their risk of recurrence, particularly women who don't get a good response from the first set of medicines that we use, and they have what was already mentioned, residual disease or disease that's left over at the time of surgery, and how we can select giving those patients more therapy to benefit them, while women who have lower risk disease and maybe have already responded really well, we can back off, give less therapy, and have less toxicity. So I think that's really one of the main goals that we're focused on right now in this area of breast cancer treatment.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you. And Dr. Fisher?
Yeah, I think I'd like to echo that. You know, in other subtypes of breast cancer, the trend in the last years has been tailoring treatment to the individual characteristics of that patient's cancer, working to do what we call de-escalate treatment, meaning, you know, taking away therapies that aren't necessary and leaving only behind the things that we know are going to be beneficial. I think that's where we're hoping to head and working to head in the triple negative setting as well.
Thank you. And Dr. Yetta?
I think two key points from my side. One was I think we are increasingly recognizing the long-term toxicities of immunotherapy. While these are great drugs and help a lot of our patients with triple-negative breast cancer, I think it's important that we know about side effects and preemptively manage those. So I think we are learning that. The second thing, which was really, and I think it's important for this group to know about as well, was that trial that I talked about with early intervention, more close monitoring of symptoms leading to improvement in overall survival. I think that's just fascinating. And I think the key take home from that is that patients, as you guys are listening to this call, they need to advocate for themselves as well. And, you know that if they have significant symptoms, reaching out to their doctors, their physicians early on might actually change long-term outcomes. And I think that we as physicians need to do better as well. But for now, until health systems are better equipped to do that, I think from patient side, advocating for yourself and asking to talk to your doctors or to your care team if there are significant symptoms, I think that's a key takeaway for me.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you, and Dr. and Ms. Brothers.
I just want to invite everyone to come and find us online at tnbcfoundation.org and come and check out our programs, and also keep an eye out on social media for TNBC Awareness Month that's happening in March. So we'll have lots of programs during the month of March as well.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And Ms. Saf.
Navigating a TNBC diagnosis can be challenging, and you don't need to do it alone. So the TNBC Foundation, in partnership with Cancer Care, again, offers that free service to help you get connected to emotional support, offer practical assistance. We really want to make sure that you feel heard and supported throughout the journey. So again, that number is 877-880-8622. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. And I just want to remind everyone that we'll be sending you both, you'll be getting a SurveyMonkey evaluation in about a week, and in that evaluation will be, it's an evaluation of the program, but also it will give you a chance. We will put all the any resource we mentioned during the program, we'll provide that for you to have. I mean, the phone numbers or websites that we gave, or even some that we may not have given, but we want to have you to have, you'll have those. So be sure you don't just see this as an evaluation, but also see it as getting some additional resources. Again, I want to just thank everyone for your participation today. This has been a really amazing program with so many questions. And, of course, unfortunately, with all the people on the call and all the questions we had, we couldn't take everyone's question. We took some questions. So what I would like you all to do is, if you were able to ask a question or in queue and asked your question, also take that question and ask your physician. Because they know you the best, they have your medical records, and they would be a really good person to, again, you've learned a lot from today's program, so be sure to ask that question. In addition, I would also suggest for those of you in queue who didn't get to ask a question, take your question to your healthcare team again, because they, again, know you the best, and they'll be able to address your question as well. And please ask your questions as often as possible. Also, I do want to remind everybody that it is very important that you know how to reach your physicians on weekends, evenings, and holidays. And although we've just come through a whole bunch of holidays, nevertheless, it's good to have those after-hours numbers to reach your healthcare team. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.